Ooh, you are listening to episode 272 of the Punk News Podcast.
Chain noises, squeaky door.
Back to the Punk News Podcast, the Halloween episode. We got spooky noises, spooky vampires, spooky mummies, and that wonderful sound effects engineer, Adam White, managing editor. Adam White, do you prefer the mummy, Dracula, Wolfman, or the creature from the Black Lagoon? Who do you prefer?
First of all, I stole that bad sound effects bit from Elliot Kalin at the Flophouse podcast. So, sorry about that. But anyways, I'm going to go mummy.
The mummy.
I mean, I have a pretty good reason for this is that like of any of those, like the mummy is the one that has retained like its classic thing. Like you have a new Dracula every like 45 minutes or so. And they all are of varying degrees of watered downness. Right. So that's hard to keep consistent with. Like no one gives a shit about Dracula anymore. The Wolfman, that you get into furries and all sorts of cosplay and it's just right. It's a dangerous territory to go down the Wolfman road. Creature from the Black Lagoon has a special place in my heart. It's actually a black and white movie that we watched when I was like in grade school. And I forget why we watched it or what the purpose was, but I remember that we did at the time. But Creature from the Black Lagoon has no staying power, right? No one gives a shit about him these days.
No one cares about the Creature of the Black Lagoon.
No one cares about him at all, right? He's an also-ran, right? A little leaguer. Mummies, despite the fact that there were stupid mummy movies a few years ago, no one thinks of them as mummy movies. Like all of those, like the mummy movies, did they actually I haven't actually seen them, so I might just be talking out of my ass here, but like did any of them actually have like a dude wrapped up in white bandages walking around, or was it just like
no, it was mostly Anubis and the Rock, who was supposed to be the mummy, but now he's got like flesh and bone being back. So it was more like Stargate than it was the mummy.
Right. So that doesn't count. So of any of those, like the mummy is keeping it real. He's keeping it old school. So I'm going with the mummy.
And that right there, that questioning of horror festivities, Tom Trauma, reviews writer, and actually underdog favorite, Tom Trauma, you have a lot of fans, believe it or not. And I guess it's because you bring such a unique perspective to the podcast that we don't hear from any of the other people. Tom Trauma, who do you
pick? The bitter old man perspective. Yes, it is rare so in this day and age.
Are you a Dracula fan? Are you a Creature of the Black Lagoon? Are you mummy?
It's
Frankenstein. Frankenstein.
It's funny you should say this because every year this Grand Rapids actually has a pretty decent Comic-Con, and I'm actually currently wearing a T-shirt that has The Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein's Monster, The Mummy, The Wolfman, and Dracula on it. But as far as the mummy thing, I don't know. I just watched Monster Squad, and all it took to kill the mummy was kind of getting his toilet paper stuck on the back of the car, and he just kind of came unraveled. So I'm actually going to go with The Creature from the Black Lagoon because he's been the least bastardized of all the monsters over the years.
And this is features editor John Gentile, and I got to go with the mummy because I studied Egyptology. But the funny thing is mummies are always like 8 foot tall in movies, but if you see a mummy in real life, they're literally like 4 foot 10. And what's really cool is if you go see the body of Sekenenre Tau II, which you can see in the Egyptian Museum, he's a real Sekenenre Tau II was a badass. He was a guy that chased the Hyksos out of Egypt. So Egypt was under foreign rule, and he rallied the troops basically and made Egypt an independent state again right around – I think that was like 2100 BC. So he was like a military genius and a badass, and actually – They know that he was a super badass because it took three people to kill him because he was stabbed in the front, the back, and the side all at once, just to show what a badass he is. So Sekenenre Tau II, who was also half what they call Nubian, which means he was half like Sub-Saharan African and half Egyptian. He's the ultimate badass, and you go see him, and he's 4'11". He's like a peewee. You know what I mean?
It's like when you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and you look at like Mick Jagger's clothes from the '60s. You're like, wow, I couldn't even get my arm in there. He's like a tiny freakish little elf man.
Except for Mick Jagger's like 6'3".
No. You got to go look at the. You got to.
Mick Jagger's like six. Mick Jagger's really tall.
Oh, don't make me Google it, John.
Google it right now, Tom.
All right, I got it.
Okay. Well, you're Googling the exact height, width, and depth of Mick Jagger.
John, I will not speak to his depth.
I got to tell you the brief little Niagara Falls mummy story.
Ooh, I always love mummy stories.
Oh, so 5'10". He was just very skinny, I guess.
That's it. I thought he was hot, taller than that.
Keith Richards, 5'9". Huh. Hmm. Anyway, sorry. But his clothes are tiny. Anyway.
Mummies. Here we go. So Niagara Falls used to have this amazing museum called the Niagara Falls Museum. And it was amazing in that it was super old and super gross and super odd. Like there was an odd collection of things in there. Everything's covered in like layers of dust, and it was one of these museums that was clearly really put together probably in like the 50s or 60s, and they just left it the way that it was. So I went in there as a kid, and there was one point where they had like taxidermy two-headed goats and things like that, and like just like it was really fucked up. It was really weird. I wish it was still there. But in the old Niagara Falls Museum, they had this like unidentified Egyptian mummy that was there for forever. It was purchased by a collector, and I just looked it up, in 1860, and it had just been like hanging out here in Niagara Falls in this shitty weird museum. And then eventually in like 1999, 2000, some Egyptologists, I guess, went and did some forensics on it, and they realized that it was Ramses the First.
Ooh.
Wow.
Well, and that's crazy, because Ramses numero deux is in Egypt.
Yeah, well, this one is now too. They were like, holy shit, Ramses the First is in this fucked up Niagara Falls museum.
That's crazy.
So then they repatriated it to Egypt after that because they realized one of these things of historical significance. But I'm pretty sure that like as a kid, I was in there and like two-headed goat, Ramses the First, some rocks, you know, that was what was there.
Adam, do you know who Ramses the Second is?
Yeah, he preceded Ramses the Third.
Correct. However,
he was the condom guy.
You can question the historical accuracy of the Bible or whatever, but most likely the pharaoh referred to in the Bible is Ramses the Second. So I mean, you don't have to believe the stories, but there's certainly a real pharaoh that whoever wrote it was talking about. That's Ramses the Second. So Adam White, you saw the body of the pops of the guy that was in the Bible.
I know. It's pretty fucked up when you think
so
about it.
So it'd be Yul Brynner's dad in the Ten Commandments.
Exactly. But I mean, how insane is that? Like, this never ceases to amaze me. Like the Bible is this ancient, ancient, ancient thing that is so old you can't even contemplate it. And you saw a guy's body from that era. How insane is that, Adam?
I know. It's crazy. And like, and then I just looked up the history of this. It's like, and there's a BBC article from like 2003 that talks about this. And it ended up in this shitty, weird Niagara Falls museum because the museum bought it from some grave robbers.
You guys want to get political for a minute on the Punk News Podcast, or should we start talking about the punk rock?
I don't know. We have a lot to talk about Victory Records, but get political.
Okay. So this has been a bone of contention in archaeology for ages. And that, basically, archaeology began in the late 1800s by the Germans. The first Germans and the French were the first to really commence large-scale archaeological undertakings in Egypt. And basically, they just looted the hell out of the place. They found cool shit and took it back to Germany, took it back to France. And then England was pretty soon afterwards. And so it used to be that, you know, England was like the great empire. You know, we deserve to take this stuff because we are the preservers of history and the proper caretakers of the world, you know. And of course, modern thought is that that was a lame thing for England to do, to try to rule the world and take over the world and stuff. And so from about the 60s and 70s to about right about 2005, 2006, 2007, there was a big effort by international courts, by international policymakers to basically bring Egyptian stuff back to Egypt. And a lot of it did get brought back to Egypt. And a big part of that was because of not Muhammad Ali, the guy that came after Muhammad Ali. What the hell is his name? Mubarak, the Egyptian president Mubarak.
Muhammad Ali was definitely not the president of Egypt, but
how much you want to bet?
He was a boxer.
Muhammad Ali is one of the most important presidents in the world. Muhammad Ali is the guy that built the dam.
Is that the guy's name, Muhammad Ali?
That's why Muhammad Ali is called Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali is the guy that modernized Egypt. Muhammad Ali is the guy that took
Egypt. Don't make me Google again. No, I'm just kidding.
You can actually go see his grave and everything. Hey, that's kind of what we're talking about
right now. I don't think there's a punk rock podcast where you would hear as much ancient history talk as we just went through.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about mummies.
Congratulations.
You know, this is why people like the punk news podcast, because we do talk about interesting stuff. I'll wrap this up quickly. Anyways, and we'll put this out there for the kids to think about. So from about then, between Mubarak, who of course was ejected from his position during the Arab Spring uprising, and Zawi Hayas, who's the director of the Egyptian Antiquities, it was a joint effort between them and other people to basically bring Egyptian stuff back to Egypt. And to some degree, Egypt and England and other countries complied. They're like, "All right, it's your stuff here. That we'll send it on back to you." To some degree, they held back, and you know, England and Germany still have tons and tons of stuff. However, now that the post-Arab Spring uprising has many different implications. In Egypt, one of the main implications is that Egypt is far more reactionary than it used to be. And that means that the current Egyptian government, ever since the end of Mubarak, who was ejected from his position, is that it's a much more religious-centered government. And basically, Egyptian antiquities are considered pagan things. And what that means is they've defunded both excavation, preservation, and museum of Egyptian antiquities. What that means is, where there used to be guards with machine guns standing on dig sites, those guys are not there anymore because funding is not going into there. And radical locals, and I'm not saying all locals, I'm just saying the radical ones are going in and smashing up statues. They're smashing up pottery. They're smashing up all kinds of things. Meanwhile, the stuff in museums is degrading, not being taken care of, and frankly being looted. So the question is, is Egypt really – and this we've seen a great split of opinion in the past 3 to 4 years because of the Arab uprising – is Egypt really the best place for Egyptian antiquities in the current climate? We don't have to answer that, and maybe we'll just let the punk news kids think about that. And also think about that, you know, there was a lot of talk of the Arab uprising in the punk rock circles and in the Eastern community – not Eastern, Western community. Not everything is quite as simple as good guys versus bad guys. That's all I'm going to say. And so you can think about that. Let's talk about some mail, because we did get some mail this week. As always, you can write in your thoughts about that at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Jake. Here's what Jake said. "I listen to the Punk News podcast every week but have never felt compelled to write in until now. John G inviting listeners to write in and get nostalgic about one of the best anti-drug commercials of all time is what it took to get me to compose this email." And of course, Jake is referring to our question from last week, and our question was last week was, from whence does this quote come? "I learned it from you, Dad."
Oh, I remember that.
And this is what Jake said. "I have very vivid memories of watching the disheveled father walking in into his son's room, interrupting the kid's air drumming session, even though there was a guitar sitting right next to him, to confront him about a large box of drugs that this young man's mother found in his closet. We learned at the end of the commercial, after the father grills his son about his drug use and asking, 'Who taught you how to do this stuff?' the son responds, 'I learned it by watching you, Dad. I learned it by watching you.' Powerful stuff, man. This commercial must have made a large impression on me and many other kids in the late 80s who tuned into the TV and into the late 80s to watch programs like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Pee-wee's Playhouse, and the Super Mario Brothers show. I have trouble recounting any specifics from those programs despite watching them all the time, but I remember this PSA quite distinctly. Maybe this PSA, this public service announcement, is one of the reasons why I am 30 years old and still straight edge. Anyways, guys, I love the podcast and listen every week. I especially love the record collecting talk. Keep it up." And that's from Jake.
I still don't remember this commercial, but I have found it, and it'll be up with the story that goes with this article. And
maybe I'm pretty sure it was an American thing, so it probably didn't broadcast on Canadian networks.
I remember it very well, but the fact of the matter is I was a teenager. You guys would have probably only been little kids, honestly, when that ran.
And this is from Laura. Here's what Laura said. Dear Punk News Podcast, I am loving all this soda commercial talk. The first time I have ever listened to your podcast, and I hope there is as much Pepsi and Coca-Cola talk in every episode. And that's from Laura. And now this is a weird one. I probably should read this one, but I can't ever resist. This is really weird. If you remember last week, we talked about how we thought what Wurr said, the homophobic things he said, we thought that was lame and that they shouldn't say that. Well, we thought it was lame, and we were just basically saying we don't agree with what they're saying, and it was not a nice thing to say. Someone named Travis wrote in, and he said, "The only reason you guys don't like shoegaze is because you hate yourselves and don't think – you deserve to be happy. Wurr rules." And so I responded to this, Travis. And I said, Adam White quite just directly said he liked shoegaze, and I said I had no opinion. And then here's what Travis replied. "Your podcast is based on lies. Lies. Learn to love yourself while there's still time." And then that was it.
I mean, I'm a big fan of, like, Loveless and everything, but like that's like the shoegaze record, so it kind of feels like someone who like owns a copy of like Nevermind the Bollocks being like, "I'm into punk rock." Like, I don't feel right saying I'm a shoegaze person because I like Loveless, because like fucking everyone loves Loveless.
You didn't like shoegaze, and I had no comment.
People hear what they want to hear, John.
But that's, they
just
do.
Like, people drink what they want to drink, and what people want to drink is the smooth taste of Pepsi Cola.
You know, the right one. You know what, Adam? You got the right one, baby.
Yeah, I gotta throw in here. So I do hate shoegaze. Let me go on the record as saying that I have zero interest in shoegaze. There's much better boring music to listen to than shoegaze. And interestingly enough, the last 12 years, my occupation has been making pop fizzy. Believe it or not, I'm a carbonation man. That's what that's what I've done for a living. But it's been a few months now. I can't drink this stuff anymore, quite frankly. I've given it up. It's poison. Nobody should drink it.
What do you do? What do you do?
Well, I work on pop systems. I'm actually leaving at the end of next week, but that's what I've been doing. I've been doing that more than a quarter of my life. I have spent making pop fizzy. I always joke around that I'm like responsible for 40% of West Michigan's childhood obesity.
Well, there you have it.
That's what I did.
Soda Talk, the Punk News Podcast. Mummy,
exactly. Well, it's just, you know, I always complain. Whenever I'm on, you guys always talk about the new bands. I swear, I listen to the podcast. You guys are talking about stuff right in my wheelhouse. Whenever I'm on, it's always like, you know, the new Conor Oberst band. And I just, a little pop talk. It's right up my alley. I put the fizz in your pop, baby.
Tom, what is the best soda pop?
I'm going to say Faygo, Rock and Rye. You get Faygo over by you, John?
Faygo. Oh, God. That's just horrible.
I'm shilling for a Michigan product. Oh. But Rock and Rye, you never
– I had Faygo Cola once, and it was like battery
acid. Oh, yeah. That's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. But it's all battery acid. That's what I'm going from being the guy who made the pop fizzy to being the anti-pop crusader. Man, if I'm going to get some empty calories, I'm drinking beer. But that's just me.
Well, there you have it. Adam White, that's a spooky –
but I still hate shoegaze.
That's a spooky warning about soda. Adam White, do you have anything else spooky to play for the Punk News listeners?
Well, we should. So we're recording this, and it's a couple days before Halloween. And by the time everyone hears this, it'll be the day after. So we're gonna play some Halloween music, John. And what I mean by that is that we're not gonna play your monster mashes, because no one wants to hear that anymore. So let's throughout this show play some stuff that that reminds us of our youths, of our Halloweens of yore. So the first one I'm going to play here, this is going to be super obvious, and everyone should have heard this, but I have a big soft spot for this era of this band. So we're going to play a track off AFI's All Hallows EP. This came out in 1999 on Nitro Records. Four songs, including a cover of Halloween by the Misfits, which is a super obvious thing to do. And this was done by the band at the time when I remember everyone really angry that AFI was ripping off the Misfits so much. But on the one hand, that they covered Halloween, so like how much on the nose can you be with that? Like, I don't think it was anything they were trying to hide. But anyways, though, this was a great little set. I love this EP still. It's it's got really cool Alan Forbes cover art from the era before AFI got too serious, and they had really fun cartoony Alan Forbes cover art. So this is the first track off that. This is Fall Children by AFI from 1999. We are back on a maybe inappropriately spooky punk news podcast, because by the time anyone listens to this, Halloween will be over and you'll all be sick of hearing about this shit. But hey, it's not old for us, so we're just going to do it. So we're going to talk about a bunch of things that happened this past week, the first of which is that the full list of releases for this year's Black Friday edition of Record Store Day has been made available. You can find a link to the full list over on Punk News. The Record Store Day Black Friday, by the way, is on November 27th of this year. Some of the artists that have releases coming out include Mr. David Bowie, The Buzzcocks, The Clash, Faith No More, Megadeth, and a bunch more. John, I guess two questions for you. One, is this too much Record Store Day? And two, opinion aside, what on this list do you want?
You know, I am pro Record Store Day. The reason I like Record Store Day is because it's a day where things that wouldn't normally be able to get produced because they don't have a huge fan base are able to get produced. So you get cool little knickknacks and just cool records. That being said, is Record Store Day's and actually, if you recall, I actually turned my back on Record Store Day about 2 years ago. But last year was so cool, I had to turn back around and say I love Record Store Day because they put out like Tegan and Sarah and Off Records and a bunch of really cool stuff. Last Record Store Day was really cool, honestly. But I do wonder if they're sort of getting tapped out. I think there is record store record store day fatigue. I think people are tired of shelling out $16 for a 7-inch, $40, even $50 for a 12-inch. And plus, this year's list just is not that inspired. I mean, they're putting out a 12-inch single of Bohemian Rhapsody. Who needs that? You know, like why? You know, they're reissuing the Clash's first album, and the only difference is it's on a different colored vinyl than before. I mean, who cares? I'd much rather have a new Clash Live album, of which there are tons of, you know, mastered to be a professionally released instead of just a record everyone already has that people will just buy for a different colored vinyl, which is completely pointless if you ask
On White Riot / Protex Blue split vinyl, which is ridiculous.
Honestly, that's so corny. You know what I mean? It's basically, I think Record Store Day has constantly been saying, we're about supporting record stores. It's not about the product per se. It's about the record store. But they're kind of just putting out like a re-release of the Buzzcocks record, Another Music in a Different Kitchen, that just got re-released. You know, one of David Bowie's crappier records. No one needs that. Like no one wants this stuff. But people – well, see, what it is no one wants it, but the collectors and people thought, well, I need to get it because I'm a collector. But I think Record Store Day is coming out is running low on goodwill. And so basically, I think if Record Store Day wants to maintain their name and keep getting people excited, like they're putting out Earth, Wind & Fire's greatest hits. You can find that in any dollar bin anywhere. Like no one needs to spend $35 on Earth, Wind & Fire's greatest hits. That is a prototypical dollar store record. You know what I mean? I mean dollar bin record. There's nothing that exciting here. The only thing that I might get is the Judas Priest 10-inch, just because it's – well, I like Judas Priest and I mean, it's a Painkiller with a touch of evil, and another track from the Painkiller album on the other side. But I mean, I have those songs. I'm more about the music than I am about the format, you know. So this, and you know, Paul McCartney say on 12-inch vinyl. Why, you know, like there's nothing here that really is exciting. And I think if Record Store Day wants to maintain its name or improve its name, they need to start putting out more inspired releases instead of just same old, you know, re-releases of records that everyone has already. So
I saw one little gem. See, I'm a big fan / collector of Midwest punk and hardcore. There's one little gem on there that I saw, and that would be the Clip Boys really early 80s 7-inch. And I thought this list was as good as Record Store Day. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong, but I remember not really seeing anything that really turned me on that much during Record Store Day. I thought there was a couple of cool things on here. Dictators, like I said, Clip Boys. I don't know.
Dictators release is the one that I thought was maybe the most interesting. I don't know how rare it is, but it seems kind of weird.
Oh, you know what it is, Adam? It's actually really weird.
It's new, yeah, right?
So I was just that's why it popped into my head. I was looking at the description here. So this is the Next Big Thing EP. It is Andrew WK's 2015 remixes and studio outtakes, taking songs from the Dictators classic Go Girl Crazy.
Oh, that's
plus some alternative takes. So it's AWK doing some Dictators remixes, which is at least like kind of weird, and I appreciate that.
At least it's not widely available, I don't think.
True, but do you want to spend $35 on that, you know?
No.
But like I said, that Clip Boys 7-inch, that's a cool little if you're into 80s hardcore, especially punk and hardcore, they're a Wisconsin band, pretty obscure, but good stuff. That's my gold star pick, Clip Boys.
So I do support Record Store Day, but this one is swing and a miss mostly. I got to say, swing and a miss. Speaking of another swing and a miss, this was a big shocker. The Desaparecidos, which is Connor Oprah's punk rock band, Tom Trauma's favorite band, I'll say punk rock band in air quotes, they've canceled the rest of their tour. The reason they said is because Connor Oprah fell ill while on tour in Jacksonville, Florida, and was briefly hospitalized due to laryngitis, anxiety, and exhaustion. And I have no inside info, but whenever I read anxiety and exhaustion, I get a little question mark over my head. And then it said, in consultation with his doctors, the band has reluctantly agreed to cancel all scheduled live dates. What I find is, I mean, you know, bands canceling tours, nothing new due to illness. It happens. It's sad, but it happens. But Desaparecidos, a lot of people were excited to see Desaparecidos at Fest this year. Adam White, what do you do when the main act from your festival or your concert drops out? What do you do?
What a shit situation. I mean, like, the one good thing about Fest is that they can, you know, they can recover from this by, you know, there's enough members, ex-members of other crazy bands that are hanging around playing in other bands at Fest that it's probably really easy all of a sudden to whip together a random special set or a random reunion or even just another set from a band that everyone wants to see. So, like, given the volume of music at Fest, you know, one of the big acts dropping out, I guess doesn't make a huge hit in it. But, I mean, coming back to just the statement that they put out, I don't know why bands. Well, okay, I don't know why bands of a certain ilk need to bother with those kind of excuses. Like, I don't know. Like, I have a feeling that you know, Connor Oberst might be a special little flower of an artist compared to some of the people that we talk about. But, like, I couldn't imagine, you know, if I don't know, like, if Masked Intruder had to cancel a show. And it was because one of them had laryngitis, which is a legit thing if you're trying to sing. But why couldn't you just cancel the show and say, like, dude has laryngitis, instead of making it being like, oh, laryngitis, but also exhaustion, which the fuck does that mean, and anxiety, and his team of doctors, like his like NASA's top scientists who were looking into this. Like, that whole thing sounds like the kind of statement that you would get from, like,
Morrissey.
You know, let's leave Morrissey out of this, but, like, this is the kind of thing that you heard in, like, the 90s when all of a sudden it was like Britney Spears has disappeared. It was because she was probably having, like, a, you know, she overdosed on cocaine, but the answer was like oh, she's exhausted and was recommended by her doctors to, you know, to take it easy because of the exhaustion. Like, people have these ailments that, like, normal human beings seem to somehow manage not having,
particularly. Not to cut, sorry Tom, but like the Belgians talk about this all the time. They're like, how do you have exhaustion when you're only working 1 hour a day? Now, that understates it, of course, but, you know, I mean, like, that's what the Melvins say. Sorry, Tom, what were you saying?
And the kid who paid $300 to go to Fest, and he's a mechanic and he's busting his knuckles, or, you know, the guy who works in the coal mine is probably not I don't know that those are necessarily Connor Oberst fans, but is probably not going to have a lot of sympathy for that type of excuse. You know, you're exhausted. We're all exhausted, dude. I get it. So, I'm not maybe as sympathetic as the next guy. What can I say?
It's just weird. And, like, I mean, maybe he's legit exhausted, but, like, have you not heard other people that have made bullshit statements that sound like that? Like, even if I was exhausted, I would just be like, I broke my arm.
Exactly. Right?
Like, it's such a weird thing. So, I don't know, like, it sucks for Fest, but it's not, you know, Fest is strong. They will recover.
There's so many bands playing.
The actual Fest is just going to breeze by, and it's not going to be a blip, I think, on anyone's actual radar on the ground while it's there, because there's so much other stuff to do, right? So that's all right, but I don't know. This exhaustion.
Oh, I'm so exhausted.
Oh, exactly.
I'm so exhausted. I had to save
for the entire year working in some shitty factory to come see the show, you know, but you're exhausted, so it's okay. Go ahead and skip the tour.
I'm so exhausted.
I'm gonna be getting hate mail from Connor Oberst fans, but that's all right. They're so very exhausted. Sensitive.
So exhausted.
Are you like spraying Febreze or something, Jeff?
I'm just really exhausted. I was gonna say we're already off track, so anyway.
Are we? All right. So there is a Beastie Boys musical in the works. An article over at the Gothamist, which is a blog, they have published about how the Camden People's Theatre in London has created a Beastie Boys musical, which is titled License to Ill. The creators of the play have said that they will, quote, ensure the Beastie Boys are fully appraised of our plans for the show, end quote, even though the musical biography is completely unauthorized. Performances of the play are set to begin on November 23rd. which is also Black Friday Record Store Day, second day that date's been mentioned in the show, and will end on December 12th. You can find a link to the full article over on Punk News. Here, I'm going to read you a little bit of the description of the play from their website. So it says, "This is a brand new show about hip-hop's most notorious pranksters. Join three young New Yorkers, Mike D, MCA, and Ad-Rock, as they go from teenage punks to international rapping legends, the Beastie Boys. Created with the creative support from comedy hip-hop legends Abandoned Man and the Rubber Bandits, and using a mix of live music and DJing, Licensed to Ill travels through time from the hip hoppers of the 80s of 80s New York to the 90s gangsters of LA, all the way to the total globalization of hip hop. This loud, crazy show does to music theater what hip hop did to tracksuits. Make them cool. The Beastie Boys story sheds light on many issues still raising hackles: racism towards and within rap, misogyny, the battle for hip-hop's soul between those using it for protest and for profit. We follow the gang from teenage punks via their discovery by legendary producer Rick Rubin to their inclusion into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." So that is the description of this show. I can only hope that, just like in a children's play, someone gets to be the tree, someone gets to be Rick Rubin's beard. John, what is this?
Well, I was thinking about this story while enjoying a nice cherry Coca-Cola out in the Coca-Cola brand. And listen, man.
Poison, John. It's poison.
You can get away with this in America. I guess in England, publicity laws are different. But this is dumb. This is stupid. This press release reads like it's the back of a straight-to-store DVD. You know what I mean? Direct-to-market DVD. I'm just going to attack this press release. First of all, it says that the Beastie Boys were 90s gangsters. The Beastie Boys were never gangster rap ever. They certainly weren't ever gangsters, especially in the 90s. Maybe in 1986 to License to Ill, they were portraying gangsters, but they never were. Second, it says hip-hop made tracksuits cool. They got it backwards. Tracksuits in the late 60s and early 70s were incredibly cool, and that's what the funk musicians and soul musicians would wear in the early 70s, and that's why the early hip-hop guys like Run DMC, like Sugar Hill Gang, like Chief Rocker Busy Bee, they would wear tracksuits because that's what hip guys wore then, was tracksuits, not the other way around. Anyways, this is stupid. I mean, they talk about how the Beastie Boys are going to be fully appraised of our plans for the show. All that means is they're going to tell the Beastie Boys what they're going to do. That doesn't mean they're going to give the Beastie Boys a veto. It doesn't mean they're going to give the Beastie Boys any sort of input into the project. Basically, I mean, this is pretty disgusting, this project, if you ask me, because it's this play company or whoever making money off the Beastie Boys without the Beastie Boys' consent, particularly in the wake of the death of MCA. So I think it's bullshit, and I think it's whack, and I think it's somebody thinking they could just make an easy buck, and they're trying to shroud it in. I mean, I assume the producers like the Beastie Boys, but if the artist that you love doesn't want to be a part of the art that you're doing about them, maybe do the art about somebody else that doesn't want to be a part of it. You know, I think this is lame. I think it's poorly formed, and I'm anti. Tom Trauma, where do you stand?
Well, I think most importantly, it's probably going to be terrible.
Yeah, good point, yeah.
And, I won't be flying to England for it, certainly. When they do the revival out here, maybe. No, I'm not a big fan of this type of thing anyway. I think this will be worse than – I'm going to predict that this is going to be worse than the musical Spider-Man scored by U2. That's my prediction.
I mean, the one piece of saving grace with this is I don't get – the impression, and this is me completely being out of the loop on this and just looking at a website, but I don't get the impression this is the biggest theater in the world, and like to go see this to go see License to Ill, it'll cost £12 and it's a double bill with another play.
Oh, it really is?
Yeah, so
I take
you,
back,
you don't think the Queen will be there?
I take back most of what I said.
I mean, it may very well be horrible, and it is definitely sort of weird to, I don't know, to use the work of an artist that has so famously not wanted their work used by anyone. but I don't know how much money's really in this. Like, this might be a smaller art project than something else. It's definitely not like Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Like, I don't think Bono's scoring it. So, I mean, you know, criticism
is that,
still
is that make it, does that make it better or worse that Bono's not scoring it? I don't know.
What makes it better, for sure.
But, like, I don't know. Like, this might be some theater people goofing around. And if that's the case, like, you know, I don't want to shit on it, but it doesn't seem like a great idea to me either way.
Now I feel like a dick. Man, I take back most of what I said. I take it back.
I don't. I take back nothing.
So yeah. So anyways, there's John's foot's in his mouth for stamping on small theater.
Yeah, I know. I feel like it's like $6. I honestly, I thought this was like a big budget thing. It was like $75 to get in, but like $6.
You thought like the queen was going to be at the opening sitting in her box with her little monocle.
I did. I mean, this is basically a college or even a high school project. I'm like, this is stupid. I feel bad now.
So are we giving them far more press than they deserve?
Well, maybe. But...
hold on. I'm going to take it. Okay. I've gone and I've Googled this place, John. And, it ain't a big operation.
Oh my God, I take it back. I take it all. I feel like Scrooge after he wakes up from the...
Oh, Tom, save John from the story. Play a song.
All right, I'm gonna, since in the spirit of the Halloween season, I'm gonna play a scary song by a local band here that plays kind of a cool horror punk rockabilly kind of sound. They're called Murder Party. This song is from their self-titled EP on East Grand Records from 2013, and the song is called I'll Kill, I Swear.
Well, I robbed a liquor store today. I didn't feel good about it, but what's done is done, and now we have the cash to leave this town. Don't let them see you frown, and don't ever show any weakness. No, we gotta be tough, otherwise we'll never make it out alive. So say goodbye to everything you ever knew before, and I'd understand if you went running out the door. And I'll keep you safe, and no harm will ever come to you, I swear. And I'll kill if they even dare. I shot and killed a man today. I didn't feel good about it, but what's done is done, and now his body's lying in my trunk. We gotta ditch it somewhere good. We'll go drive it to the desert. We'll dig a deep hole, throw it in, no one will ever know. So say goodbye to everything you ever knew before, and I'd understand if you went running out the door. And I'll keep you safe, and no harm even dare. Well, I got stabbed again today. I didn't feel good about it, but what's done is done, and now I'm lying bleeding on the floor. I put a bullet in his head. There was no hesitation, but you made it easy when you strapped his body to a chair. So say goodbye to everything you ever knew before, and I'd understand if you went door. And I'll keep you safe, and no harm will ever come to you, I swear. And I'll kill if they even demons there. Why kill, I swear? Murder, murder.
We are back. That was a very coolly named murder party. My name is Adam White. You're still listening to the Punk News Podcast. And John, last week we had some fun talking about Victory Records, and then we walked it back a little bit during the show because we didn't want to get sued. Well, Victory Records is suing, but not us.
Whew, whew.
They're suing Thomas
Kalnaki.
Kalnaki. This is one of these names that I've read my entire life and I've never spoken. Oh, no,
I think it's Kalnoki. Kalnoki.
Thomas Kalnoki. They are suing the dude from Streetlight Manifesto for more than $1 million. So this came from a story from the Courthouse News Service that, John, I assume you are on their list. Victory Records has filed a lawsuit against the frontman for Streetlight Manifesto, Thomas Kalnoki. The crux of the lawsuit is that Kalnoki has purposefully been delaying releasing new material under Victory's four-album deal with the band. The label is seeking over $1 million in damages. Furthermore, the label is claiming that Kalnoki, a.k.a. Tokay, his release of solo acoustic albums is part of a scheme to thwart the contract with Victory. Specifically, Victory points to Kalnoki's The Hand That Thieves album, which was self-released and featured acoustic versions of the Streetlight Manifesto album, The Hands That Thief. Victory also claims that Kalnoki specifically encouraged fans to illegally download Victory releases. So this is an interesting story. It is absolutely not the first time Victory Records has been in the news over a contract dispute or over a lawsuit. But man, after talking about it last week, it's like, shit, here it is. John, this is a legal story, so I defer I defer all judgment to you, sir.
Well, there's so much to unpack here. We could literally spend an entire podcast talking about this. Before I thought what I wanted to talk about is I had to sit back and relax with a nice RC Cola to really think things over.
Really slumming.
But specifically, the first thing here is what is Tony Brummel hoping to get out of this? I doubt Thomas Kalnoki has $1 million.
Got $1 million bucks. Yeah.
He might have a house. So it could be it could just be some guy acting out of blind rage and not out of his economic best interest. And if that's the case, it's the attorney's job. It's always an attorney's job to ask the client, what do you want? Like winning a lawsuit is really never the goal for a client. Getting what the client wants is the goal. Sometimes the way to achieve that is winning a lawsuit. Sometimes it isn't. He's not going to get $1 million out of it, and it's going to cost him a fair amount of money if it goes to trial or even if it proceeds for a while. Maybe he's hoping for a quick settlement, or maybe he's hoping that Tokay will just shit out a Streetlight Manifesto album and say, there you go, you know, and finally we're done. Or maybe he's just, you know, acting out of blind rage and he just wants to punish him, and even though it'll economically cost Tony Brummel, he just wants to damage somebody that he sees as trying to damage him or whatever. Another important so the question is, what is Tony Victory hoping to get out of this? I don't know what Tony Victory's goal is, but if I was advising a client like this, I would say suing your artist publicly for $1 million probably is not going to get you what you want, unless what you want to get is just to be seen as a mean, nasty guy, in which case then there's a question of waste of judicial resources and a malicious prosecution. But I couldn't say, you know, I mean, maybe Thomas Kalnoki does have $1 million. I don't think he does. Second thing to take out of this is, this probably is not so much of an issue anymore, but 5, 6, 7 years ago, you know, I don't care how much money they're offering you up front, take your contract to a lawyer and have somebody look it over. Because $50,000 now looks awesome, but 8 years from now, when you still owe them two albums and you've already given them four albums and you're not gonna and you haven't seen a penny since that initial $50,000. That $50,000 is a long distant memory, and you basically you feel like an indentured servant because they keep beating you and taking, you know, and you have to keep giving them stuff, and you're not seeing anything in return aside from that initial down payment or advance rather. So you always look over any contract. It's probably not so much of an issue anymore because it's not like there's a whole lot of music money going around these days. Another interesting question is, and I'm I don't know about roughly speaking, if an artist did release acoustic albums while they had an exclusive contract with a record label and the acoustic album was identical to the studio album, except for it's acoustic instead of electric, I kind of do think there's probably a cause of action there, to tell you the truth. I think probably Thomas Kalnacki is feeling trapped, and basically I don't know if he planned his way to get out of the contract as best he could, but I haven't seen all the stuff. Lastly, just this week, a band signed to Victory Records. Just this week. And I'm thinking, what is that band thinking? Like, Victory Records has sued its bands multiple times. That's a fact. You know? So, Tom, a band signing to Victory Records, what do you think they're thinking right now? Why? You know?
Yeah, you think it's certainly there's a lot of these stories out there, and generally when there's smoke, there's fire. I don't know. You know, I guess everybody thinks it won't happen to them, or but you know, as far as him recording all that acoustic stuff, you know, there are weird rules about that stuff, because you know some of these classic rock bands that their old labels won't give them rights to their material. They'll actually go in and re-record it.
Well, no,
just and try to record them the exact same way. So I know, so he owns those sound recordings, and he might know more about it than I do. But
here's the rule: an audio record. Okay, well, there's what's called song composition and sound recording. The composition is the written song as you would write it out on a piece of paper. In the industry, that's also called publishing sometimes.
Sure.
Then there's the sound recording. The sound recording is the actual sound recording of the song as written. The sound recording is a derivative right of the song as written, the song composition. Sometimes record labels will just purchase the sound recording or license the sound recording, and they let the artist keep the publishing, that is the song composition, the written song. That means the artist can leave tomorrow and go and record a whole new version of the album because they still own the publishing, the song composition, but not the sound recording. However, it's a little murky. So, I mean, if that's the extent of the contract, that's fine. But here where it gets murky is, let's assume that Thomas Kalnacki does own his own publishing, which I bet he does, while he's under an exclusive contract to only record for Victory as Streetlight Manifesto. If he just calls himself something different and records those same songs, I kind of think there is a claim for intentional interference of contract. Which, I mean, honestly, can you imagine trying to explain to a jury why this is not intentional interference of contract? The jury's just going to say, this record label signed this guy up to record songs for only them, and now he's recording those same songs just with a different name. A jury is not going to be able to parse the difference between song composition and sound recording, and more specifically on whether or not there actually is intentional interference of economic relations.
Well, he's definitely putting his thumb in the guy's in Victory's eye, no question.
All you're going to say is ass.
No. Well, so this actually plays into a question I was going to ask you as a hypothetical, but you I think you're answering it right now, which is not about the ass thumb thing. But the typically when a label signs someone, is it signing the band or is it signing the individuals? It's got to be signing the individuals, right?
The answer is, Adam, record labels are notoriously terrible with their contracts and notoriously non-standard. Sometimes they sign the individuals. Sometimes they sign the corporation owning the band's name, which means sometimes, like look at the Temptations, look at Sweet. Sometimes the right owned by the record label is to just hire anybody they want as the band, and the former band doesn't own the name to that band, and they're out of luck.
So like, could I incorporate my band and then you sign my corporation and then I just like shutter it?
You couldn't shutter it because that corporate
or bankrupt the corporation or something, or
hypothetically, yes. And most major label contracts are that way, in that a lot of major label contracts is the deal is with the band, the company, not the members of the band who are employees of the company.
Hmm. Because, like, you get into all these really interesting hair-splitting things where, like, okay, so what if everybody that's the principal songwriters, you know, they leave the corporation that their band's been incorporated as, and then they, you know, go form a new one that's not under the contracts.
Well, then here's what would happen is the record label would sue that old corporation, and then that corporation would owe the record label, and the way the record label would get payment from that corporation is either through an injunction. Like, I mean, basically, courts aren't stupid. Like, if it's the same guys in both bands, the court would block the second guy from recording music. So, and here's an example. Black Flag couldn't record from 1981 to 1984 because of that exact issue. But also, like, they would sue the company, and assuming the company still has assets, that is, assuming the band's name is still worth money, that's how the corporation would get their money back if the band refused to record.
Hmm. There is a very good question here, which is what, you know, all of these, and Tom, you brought this up, it's just that there's a history of drama with Victory Acts. And you figure that, like, anyone getting into it this day with them has got to know the history. So, which actually makes me think that Victory might be an incredibly powerful label still. Because I think a lot of people are walking into these, you know, into these deals with Victory these days, and they're fully aware of all the shit that's gone down between Victory and some of the acts that they signed in the 90s or the early 2000s. But, like, does the Victory name command that much market share that, you know what, people are walking in and saying, hey, you know what, whatever, we'll handle Tony Victory. Like, is that what they're doing?
Do you think he's just throwing like here's $100,000?
Absolutely not. What he's most of these contracts are so bad. What he essentially is doing is loaning the band money to be paid back on the sales of these albums. That's why you see these bands are deep in debt, because they didn't sell enough records to pay back their label, which are essentially lending mechanisms. Now, I don't know, maybe Victory doesn't do that, but I know that's how most of these labels operate. There's no huge upfront that you get to keep. You have to pay that back through sales, and if you don't meet X number of units.
But, like you never hear about, like, you know, people aren't having giant public lawsuits against, like,
Fat Wreck.
You know, Fat or No Idea, or I don't know. Like,
I mean, there is a couple, you know, there's other, like Alternative Tentacles over the years has had a couple of issues like this. But yeah, most of them, like Fat Wreck, you never hear. Even Epitaph, stuff like that, you know, they're big too, but they never at least air their dirty laundry.
And so what I'm wondering is that, like if your band signs to Victory, is the amount of, like, exposure and, like, built-in audience that you get access to so much that it counterbalances the fact that you might end up in one of these situations?
I think you're a young band and you think it does, and you think this, you know, you won't end up in this situation because your album is going to catch fire, so you'll never have to worry about any of these issues. But who knows? I don't know any of the players involved personally, but, you know, some people are difficult to deal with.
That said, based on what you guys just said, by the way, the one label that I would never want to be on the lawsuit end of, I think, is Epitaph.
Why?
I don't know. Just there's.
I think Mr. Brett would just go straight for the throat.
Like Mr. Brett, please put down your gun. Like, I think that, like, I know, like I bet you that they would execute you cleanly and silently, and no one would know, and no one would find your body.
He's eating Ronnie Radke's ass.
Why are you saying that? You have an example.
Because I mean, in my head, Epitaph is probably one of the most, I want to say, like, at least I've always had the opinion that they are the most, like, professionally run tight ship of a label. Like, all their I's are dotted, all their T's are crossed, like that they are. Like they really fucking know what they're doing as far as running a business. So I assume that if they're going to sue you, they really know how to do that.
I think you're just making a very smooth segue into the Bad Religion story.
I'm just imagining Mr. Brett holding Adam off a balcony by his ankle, and Mr. Brett's like, Adam, you better sign with us. And I was like, oh my God, don't drop me. Speaking of people having issues with Epitaph.
See, that was a smooth seg, and then
I tried to segue in, but now all I can think of is Mr. Brett with, like, a cigar cutter over, like, Ronnie Radke's fingers going, you will cooperate or I'll take them one by one.
I just, like, imagining Mr. Brett as a sort of Suge Knight character and Adam White as Vanilla Ice. Anyways, Brooks Wakerman is no longer in Bad Religion. He said at Twitter, this wasn't an easy decision to make after spending a good chunk of my life in such an iconic band, but after reassessing my future in music, it was time for me to pursue another path. He left Bad Religion after joining in 2000. He was in Suicidal Tendencies before that. So, I mean, Adam White, is this a shocker? This is kind of a shocker, isn't it?
I mean, it sucks. I think it's definitely the end of the Bad Religion era that kind of started with Process of Belief and kind of brought us up till now. I think that the band is by no means done, but in the past few years, you know, like they lost Greg Henson back in, what was it? 2013, right? Ago. Yeah. So Greg Henson was out then, Brooks Wackerman's out then. So whatever the band is, when they record their next thing, and I've got to only really talk about Bad Religion as far as being a recording band, because like, I don't know, like, what do they play? Like 5 shows a year in Los Angeles or something at this point, right?
Actually, last couple of years, they've toured pretty extensively because I saw them for the True North tour. I saw them in Detroit once and Chicago twice. So they actually,
yeah,
I mean, it was just bigger cities.
I feel like True North was
2013. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. Maybe.
They've toured the last 2 summers, they've toured a lot.
All right. I'll give them
that. Now, Mr. Brett doesn't tour with them, of course, but.
Yeah, well, that's been the case kind of since they got back. Like, if you see a Bad Religion show and Mr. Brett's there, you're either in LA or you're at a very special show. But just like this, I feel that like with 2 members out, they are legitimately a different band now. Whatever they do next is going to be a new group. Like the dynamics in the room are going to be different, and Brooks was such a big part of giving them, I think, that like that kind of added kick in the ass
with
Process of Belief. Because I mean, like,
between that back to Epitaph, a lot of things
were lining up for that to be a special record. I mean, they were back on Epitaph, Brett was back in the songwriting mix and everything like that. But, you know, not to speak, you know, any ill of Bobby Shayer or anything like that, but you know, if you listen to The New America and then you listen to Process, like the first song on Process of Belief, which is Supersonic, right? It's a kick in the face compared to like anything that Bad Religion had recorded in the past like 2 or 3 years. And this is in the good kick in the face realm, not a bad kick in the face. Like the band was just supercharged at that point. And I got to imagine that, you know, that Brooks behind the kit was a big part of you know, them being that band that they were. So, you know, it's been over 10 years since Process. So it's, you know,
2002.
Yeah, it's now a different band, I guess. And it'll remains to be seen what they sound like. I mean, like the biggest thing that you can credit like a band that's been around for this long is if they release a new record and they sound vital, that they don't sound tired, right? And that's whenever you have one of these old punk bands that does a really good record these days, that's the key. Like, it doesn't matter if it sounds like their old stuff, because we kind of expect that, but we want it to sound vital. So Process of Belief sounded vital. Like anything that, you know, that Off is doing sounds vital. Anything that, you know, that you think about like the self-titled Buzzcocks record that they released a few years back, like that sounded vital. Didn't matter if they were old guys that were still recording with the same band they've been with for 30 years. Like those ones, like they sounded that way. So the big test.
I would argue that True North sounded that way, quite frankly.
Yeah, and I don't think that the quality really dipped on the Bad Religion stuff that they released since Process. I mean, there were some weird bits, but not it, like it was pretty.
Some of them were a little slower, but yeah, the songs were almost all good.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been a huge fan. I've always been a huge fan of Bad Religion, but I've been a huge fan of the Bad Religion stuff that they released since 2002, because like it all sounded really, really good. Like it sounded like they had just matured in a really nice way that a lot of bands that have just been playing stuff for years, they don't have that. Like if, you know, I don't think they're recording right now, but like if, you know, if Pennywise went and you pulled the last Pennywise record out or something, it's probably not going to have that same, you know, that same sense of purpose, I guess, that the Bad Religion stuff that is since 2002. So yeah. So Brooks being out of the band along with Greg Henson being out of the band, those two things, I think they're gonna add up, and they're gonna make the next move is gonna be one where they're gonna have to prove themselves again.
You think it's gonna be Josh Freeze like it always is?
Mikey Erg.
I've heard. Well, who'd have, I've
heard this would be a sweet gig for Mikey Erg, better than the Against Me gig, I think.
Mikey Erg. I heard somewhere that someone posted on Twitter that like Mikey Erg is in something like 13 bands that are playing at Fest this year.
So only like five less than Josh Freeze.
Yeah. So that's the thing is like I wish all the best for Mikey Erg, and if one of the things on his list is to be in Bad Religion, then great. But like, I don't know if I need to hear any more Josh Freeze bands. No offense to the guy. Like, I don't want to. Like, I don't. A bunch of people were saying like Adam Willard. But like these are like, do we have like three punk rock session drummers that just play in all the bands? Like,
I'm actually pushing for the return of Chuck Biscuits. I think he would be great in that.
Was he ever in Bad Religion?
No, he wasn't. But he, and as a matter of fact, I don't think he's in music at all anymore.
Like is there not some like kick ass drummer playing in like a fucking speed metal band or something that you can go get and like, you know, bring him up to the big leagues and stick him in Bad Religion?
One of the highlights of my concert going year is I went to Chicago and saw him play back to back nights at the Metro, which is a real intimate club. And they were doing the Battle of the Centuries thing. So the first night they played 80 to 2000 songs. And the second night they played 2000 to 2015 songs. And it was great fun. It was really excellent.
Wait, did you say they played 2000 to 2015 years?
Well, the second year they played from 2000 to 2015.
Right. You just said back in your concert-going days. Do you mean like last week?
What's that? No, it was in the summer. Back in the concert. Did I say – well, okay, I said that wrong then.
Back in your youth, say, which just –
No, it was this summer. It was this summer. It was definitely not in my youth.
You said back in my concert-going days, meaning this past summer.
Yeah, well, okay. I said that poorly then. But anyway, Greg, as a matter of fact, he said he actually made some comment from the stage about, you know, how our music is much more driving after 2000? It's because of this guy. And he actually like called Wackerman out on stage, which was kind of interesting. But anyway, I'd be curious to I think they can make the transition. They're just one of those bands. I think the key songwriting of Mr. Brett and Greg can survive. In my humble opinion.
Pure speculation. Do you think it was an amicable split or a non-amicable split?
I think I don't have any reason not to believe that it was amicable. You know, he's quite a bit younger than the rest of those guys.
Yeah, and you know what?
It was not that camaraderie probably that like, the other guys
what,
have.
Like 13 years or so he was in the band or so. Like, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah.
I always feel that, like, if you quit your band after 2 years, then okay, then you got in a fight. If you quit your band after 15 years, then all right, you know, you're just moving on in your life. If you quit your band after like 30 years, then you've become like an old grump and you've gotten in another fight. Like, there's some sort of window.
Let's not pick on Geezer, Bill Ward.
Bill Ward's available for Bad Religion.
I don't think he can play that fast, but.
Anyway, Adam, you know, you were talking about a kick in the face. Do you remember the time that you and I wanted to leave Epitaph Records and get out of our contract? And Mr. Brett just held us down and kicked us in the face for a half hour?
He said no one would believe us, John.
So anyway, talking about a kick in the face, though. Flag! They're back! They're back! They're back! I'm almost as excited as when they returned to Coke instead of New Coke. Flag has announced some European tours on Twitter and Facebook. Chuck Dukowski says he's excited to be back, and they're going to keep doing dates. I don't know if there's a whole lot to say about this. This is what I have to say about this. Go see Flag. I saw them twice. It was literally two of the best concerts I've ever seen. Flag is every bit as amazing as you will hope they will be. It's just amazing. It is the music of Black Flag handled by Black Flag's greatest musicians, minus Greg Ginn, who's not that great anymore. He used to be good, but he's not that great anymore. And Keith Morris is in his prime. Chuck Dukowski is in his prime. Bill Stevenson is in his prime. Steven Egerton is in his prime. And, well, I would say Dez is in his prime, but he was sick. But I'm happy to see that Dez is touring again, so maybe Dez has gotten over his cancer scare. And so go see Flag. Flag rules. I don't know if any of you guys have anything to say about this. It's an amazing, awesome show, and I'm so happy that they're touring again, and I so hope they come back to Philadelphia. Well, anyone on the East Coast, if they play the East Coast, I'll be there.
I saw them also, and it was pretty awesome. I think Dez actually just faked being sick so he could get out of the current version of the Misfits, but I have no insider information of that. But But they are cool. Unfortunately, they're one of those bands. They're playing mostly, and I think they're pretty much going to play festival shows. You know, they're not gonna play a club by me. They're probably not even going to play Detroit. Maybe Chicago, but.
Saw them in a club, Tom.
But Philadelphia, man, they got some kind of mojo working over there. We don't have that here.
No, I saw them in a smaller club than that in Cleveland.
Ah, nice. See, that's only a few hour drive for me.
You should have went to that time. That was awesome.
I should. Next time, man. I'll meet you in Cleveland, John.
Sounds like a plan. Adam White, closing word on Flag.
Flag! They, what do you want, John? Well, how can I possibly match your level of enthusiasm here?
I have something that I can't – well, I shouldn't – Flag rules. Go see Flag. Let's close out tonight's podcast. Halloween's over, but you know, you guys know what day November 1st is? Adam White, Tom Trom, you know what day November 1st is?
November 1st.
It's a Sunday this year.
Oh.
How fitting. The day of birth, November 1st, is Samhain / Shaw Wayne / Sahoon. Glenn Danzig's second, least known, but arguably the best band. So let's play Shaw Wayne by Shaw Wayne featuring Glenn Danzig off the album Initium. We talked about mummies. We talked about getting kicked in the face. We talked about lawsuits. We talked about the delicious taste of Sprite. We talked about Desperacitos and the BC Boys. I had to eat my hat. Guys, I think this was a pretty good, a pretty jam-packed episode, a pretty jam-packed podcast. What do you guys think?
You know, we learned, and we taught. We did everything you could hope.
This was a pretty fired up show. I don't know why.
Well, listen, we love getting your mail. Reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see y'all next week. And in the meantime, go check out some Tab soda, the first diet soda. See you later.